Danville Overhead Doors for its support of Focus 580. Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in Central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, imported foods from Europe, the Middle East, India, and around the world. Food tastings are held every Saturday from 11 to 5. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University Avenue in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in today for David Inge. Glad you could listen. During this first hour of the show, we'll have a program we call Talk to the Veterinarian. Actually, veterinarians, because we have two with us. Stephen Marks, he's the head, chief of small animal medicine at the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. And Julia Whittington, she's assistant professor of veterinary medicine. They're both here at the U of I. And they join us every once in a while to take your questions on the care of animals, their health and their behavior, a variety of issues we all face with our animal companions. In addition, Julia Whittington specializes in wildlife, so we can take questions about the critters that don't live with us but around us as well. So if you have questions along those lines during this hour, all you have to do is call us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest, or if you're listening on the internet anywhere in the continental U.S., that toll-free line is 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Well, to both of you, good morning.
Thank you for having us.
Good morning.
Well, thanks for being here with us again. There are a number of issues we could talk about. We were just chatting before the show about some of the maybe epidemiological issues with regard to wild animals in particular, and this year doesn't seem so bad, or what would you say?
I would say that we certainly have the same diseases to some level in the populations, but we do seem to be reaching some sort of steady state in the numbers that are presented to us. Certainly, the state is still surveying for animals that are found dead in the environment, and we work with our diagnostic lab and the state to try to identify trends in animal diseases that are presented through the wildlife clinic. But things seem to be fairly calm right now. Certainly, West Nile is still on the horizon, and we do seem to get a peak in our cases come late summer, fall. So we may still be inundated, but for right now, we're okay.
Certainly looks like not near as bad as last year or the year before. I think somebody mentioned that there was an item in the news this morning, only one human case detected in Illinois of West Nile virus.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good thing.
That's a good thing. We're happy for that.
I also heard in the news this morning on WILL, I listen to the station in addition to talk on it occasionally, that there is a real overpopulation of deer right now.
You bet. Yeah. It's, even here at the university campus, it's not uncommon to see deer right in the main campus on the quad. So, yes, the deer are very thick in some areas, and I understand Allerton is going to have a controlled hunt this fall. So we've seen a lot of deer this spring and summer, mostly fawns, and we see them mostly for trauma, situations hit by cars or attacked by domestic pets, things along those lines. But there is no shortage of them. And we are, again, working with the diagnostic lab and the state to screen for chronic wasting disease, which is a big concern among hunters as well as health officials.
Well, I might want to follow up on that, but I just as a note, I heard on the news that in Allerton Park, for example, the overpopulation is such that the last count was 160 deer per square mile.
Wow. It's a lot of deer.
Which is, you almost have to watch your step or
exactly.
Something. It's pretty amazing. Well, we do have a caller to talk with. Why don't we do that? This is a listener, not sure quite where, actually in Indiana, line number 4. Good morning.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Next door to where I live is basically an empty lot, and water collects in a small pond that was probably used for goldfish years ago, and it doesn't drain out, and it's about 8 to 10 feet long, 4 to 5 feet wide, and I've been checking it out because I know mosquitoes love those kinds of things, and I was wondering if there's anything, I remember when I was a child, they used to pour some kind of oil in marshes and things to cover with a film so that the larva couldn't come up to the surface and breathe. Is there anything that I could pour on that that it's not going to ruin vegetation around the side of it or anything like that?
Yes, there are products that you can use to effectively control the larva development. I would avoid any sort of oil product because you will damage the foliage as well as some of the biological life that is in the pond, okay. Bacteria as well as wildlife. I would recommend contacting your public health department, and they can probably hook you up with some people who could get you into in touch with people who have the right chemical. But okay. Certainly there are things you can use, and that would be a very good mosquito control technique for you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. I remember that Sandy Mason from the University of Illinois Extension brought in these pellets once. There are these sort of round donut-shaped things that are designed to control mosquitoes in ponds and things like that, and supposedly aren't toxic for human beings and other animals and plants and so forth. So maybe that's one of those kinds of products you were mentioning.
Mm-hmm. It's actually worth checking into pretty extensively because for that gentleman that has this water near his home, other domestic pets walking up to it and drinking it in. There actually have been some precedents already set where strictly organic items have been introduced into waterways, specifically some fungal organisms that would actually take care of or thought to take care of mosquito organisms. And actually, it was not thought to be infectious to other domestic species. And we found that it has caused harm in those species.
Oh, okay.
And that was actually documented in Louisiana where they introduced that into some of the natural waterways. So you do have to be careful, like Dr. Whittington's suggesting.
Yeah. Well, very good. We have a couple other callers here. Someone on a cell phone next on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. I was wondering if it's safe to give dogs generic Benadryl over the counter for their allergy symptoms, the scratchy and itching.
Benadryl is diphenhydramine, which is an antihistamine, and it is fairly safe, but I would not do that without taking some direction from your veterinarian. Even though the over-the-counter strength is over-the-counter strength, it still can cause problems if given in a patient that's not absolutely healthy. So for the most part, it's safe. If you absolutely have to do this, then I would follow the recommendations for pediatric dosing, so for children, and then you're usually fairly safe. But I would still do that under the direction of your veterinarian because the dosing can be different for different size pets.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Thanks for the call. Next up, someone on line number four in Piatt County. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question about a poodle. She's 12, and we've noticed that she's beginning to get more, we call them warts, on her paws and on her back and on her head. And the problem is that when she gets groomed, even though they're very careful, it nicks these, and then she has started licking excessively the one on her leg. Is just bad, or is there anything that can be done about this, or should we not even worry?
I think it's always a good idea to to consult with your veterinarian.
Mm-hmm.
Typically these are benign. Mm-hmm. And they're not much to be concerned about, but if they continually get nicked or mm-hmm. the pet is continually chewing on them,
yes,
then you can see secondary bacterial infection and they become a nuisance. So in a 12-year-old, assuming that pet is healthy otherwise,
yes,
those could be fairly easily removed, and especially if you can combine them with another event. For example, if your pet needed a dentistry,
mm-hmm.
then while the pet was under anesthesia, your veterinarian may be able to do the dentistry and just take the most prominent papillomas or warts off.
Okay.
And I would certainly touch base with your veterinarian, especially if this is a chronic problem.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call. We had a question off the air. Someone wanted to know how to keep a raccoon out of a garden without harming the raccoon. Good luck.
Exactly. There's going to be very little that you can do to prevent a raccoon from going pretty much anywhere it wants to go. whenever you have wildlife that you would consider nuisance, then you need to start looking at what they're using for their habitat and what they're using for their groceries, and try to make it as undesirable for them as possible. But if you have a garden, then they're going to come because that's a smorgasbord for them and they think that's terrific. If you have wood piles or if you have an outbuilding that perhaps is not being used, a shed that they can gain access to that they would use as a nesting site, although fortunately most of our raccoons are done nesting, then you would want to close that area off. Some people will recommend actually playing noxious music during the times when a raccoon would be trying to sleep, which is during the day, to detour them from hanging around the area. But it's very challenging to remove a raccoon family once they've established a domicile in your area. So
they're very clever creatures,
they
raccoons.
They are incredibly clever, and they are extremely dexterous, so they can get into places you wouldn't suspect that they could.
Mm-hmm. They're very cute, but you don't want to play with them either, do you?
No, raccoons can be they can be challenging. They carry some diseases. Some people, because they're very cute, they are very adorable as babies. Some people are tempted, although it's illegal, to keep them as pets, but that's quite dangerous. Raccoons can be carriers of rabies. We don't have raccoon rabies in Illinois at this point, but they can be carriers. Certainly they can carry diseases that your domestic dog or cat can have. And they carry a roundworm, a parasite, that is transmissible to people and can be quite serious, especially in children. So it's a very good idea to keep wildlife wild and not interact with them on a close relationship.
We have another caller. Let's include them. This is a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning.
Good morning, Dr. Marks, Dr. Whittington. Thanks for doing the show. I appreciate that. I have a wildlife question for Dr. Whittington. Seeing a lot, especially in my neighborhood this time of year, of the baby everything, pretty much, spring into the summer, seeing the baby squirrels, baby rabbits, baby robins, and all kinds of other little birds, especially with the storms we've been having lately and things, a lot of them getting blown out of nests. My neighbors have had some problems with their animals getting a hold of these animals. How do we know whether these animals are in danger and need help from your clinic, or whether we should leave them alone, let nature take its course, let mom take care of them, or that sort of thing? Can you give us some advice as far as that goes, so we don't end up pulling completely healthy animals out of their nests and bringing them to a clinic where they don't need to be?
Well, that's an excellent question. You sound like maybe you've brought some animals into the wildlife clinic before.
Maybe a couple.
Mm-hmm. Certainly wild animals have to learn how to take care of themselves, and they are under the care of their parents for quite some time. When you have a situation where you see wildlife orphans or babies, it's important to determine whether or not they truly need your care, as you suggested. If you see an animal that is not moving around much, that is obviously injured, maybe drooping a wing or has a wound on it, or seems to be not thriving, then that is an animal that would potentially need some care. However, with the series of storms we've had lately, a lot of animals just get displaced out of nests, and all they need is for you to replace them in as close of proximity as you can to where they came from. And sometimes that means that you use your creativity and create a new nest. For instance, if you see a fledgling bird or a nestling bird that's fallen out of a nest but you can't reach the nest, you can create one out of a butter tub, poking holes in the bottom, and just hang it from the closest branch that you can find. Wildlife parents have invested an incredible amount of energy and time into raising these babies, and they will take them back. It does not matter if you touch them. The animals, the babies will vocalize, and the parents will come back to care for them. So the best chance for survival of these wildlife babies is to leave them in their natural situation and allow their parents to care for them.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. This year, there seems to be an incredible abundance of wildlife of all kinds. Certainly, the plants around this area are doing marvelous. And I've certainly noticed a lot more rabbits and all kinds of critters. Is it just because of the weather this year or something? Or
we have natural fluxes, yeah. I guess, in the populations, yeah. you would say. Some years we tend to get more of one species than another, and I think that's just the natural variability of the population, as well as where people are spending their time. Certainly wildlife, one of their best defenses is to stay out of sight. You know, we yeah. are one of their predators. And so if the weather's nice and the foliage is green and we're out in the woods, we're going to be apt to come across them more likely. But like I said, we've seen a large number of chelonians or turtles this year. They're out laying their eggs. The environment is ripe for them to be very productive, and so they're going to be crossing those roads and getting hit by cars. And we have seen a large number of different wildlife mammals. We've had really good weather, so the breeding season seems to have been extended this year.
Let me just reintroduce our guests this morning during this hour, Focus 580. We're talking with a couple of veterinarians from the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. Stephen Marks, he's chief of small animal medicine, and Julia Whittington, she's assistant professor and also directs the wildlife clinic here at the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. We're taking your questions. If you would like to call us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Would you like to maybe sort of describe the wildlife clinic and the kind of work you do there?
I'd love to. The wildlife clinic is a really unique environment for not only the patients that we see, but also for the opportunity it affords the students, the veterinary students. We've been in existence since 1978 in some form or another, and we're housed at the Small Animal Clinic, and Dr. Marks is actually the head of the section that we fall under. We receive any wild animal, native species. We are not able to accept bats or skunks, as they are carriers of rabies in Illinois. But we will take pretty much everything else. We try to avoid taking in healthy orphans simply because we don't have the resources to care for them appropriately. But we are run, we are not-for-profit. We're run strictly on donations. We've got a lot of wonderful friends in this community who have been very supportive of us. We are completely run by volunteers. Veterinary students comprise the bulk of our workers, and they spend hours upon hours of caring for these animals. We do have to euthanize animals. Our goal is not to turn them into pets. So there are times when if an animal is deemed unreleasable, maybe they have a wing injury that would prevent them from flying ever again, then it is the most humane thing for us to euthanize them. And that's still a service that we are providing these animals, because otherwise they would be left to starve or be eaten in the wild. Mm-hmm. So it's a really unique opportunity. Another fun thing that we offer, if people are interested in the community, they can contact us, and we are happy to come out and give educational programs to schools or groups of people to talk to them about wildlife. And we have some birds of prey that we are able to take out and show people about their native wildlife.
That's great. Well, I know that, you know, in general, the College of Veterinary Medicine has a lot of really great services. And, you know, we've certainly used and benefited from the small animal clinic there. Stephen, you were mentioning before one of the services that seems to be a pretty important component is this the grief counseling, grief management, that you actually have a counselor that deals with people on those issues.
Yeah, so we're actually one of the only veterinary schools in the country that provides that type of service. And, I mean, it's fairly straightforward to recognize the need for a person in that area. And veterinarians, just due to their training within veterinary medicine and the job that they do, become fairly proficient at counseling pet owners with very sick pets and certainly when they lose their pets. And that really applies to all species, whether it be some of the exotic or pocket pets, horses, cows, because we do see people that have those as companion animals, and dogs and cats. And this service is really allowing someone that's professionally trained in that area to talk to someone, so not just about the veterinary medical aspects, but more relating it to the human-animal bond and really the emotions that we all go through. And everyone goes through them differently, and having somebody professionally trained to just sit down and say, as a person with training that's compassionate, to help understand what people are going through. Mm-hmm. It really has made a big difference in how we practice the art of veterinary medicine. And I actually, you know, obviously I have a bias, but I think we potentially do it better in a lot of ways than our counterparts do in human medicine, because we take the time to take care of the patient, which is not a person, and to take care of the other family member, which is the pet owner.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is kind of a whole package approach.
Well, I like the way you said family member, because they are family members.
I mean, there's a huge body of literature on the human-animal bond and the pluses of that relationship, both just to everyday mental health, but also physical health.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's well documented in the literature. That's not just, you know, that's not just my opinion. And so it makes a huge difference in recognizing it. And all the way down from the pet owner that has, you know, maybe a pet that you wouldn't consider that bond, like, you know, a pet rat or a pet bird. I don't think it's any different, because that relationship is still the same. As it would be between a pet owner and a dog, or a pet owner and a cat, or a pet owner and a horse.
Very interesting. Well, and we all, you know, those of us who have these family members who are non-human, basically it's inevitable that we're going to be dealing with the end of their life, because our lifespans are so much longer than theirs. We have a dog, for example, who's 14 years old. She's still very healthy, but she's definitely showing signs that she's in her last decade of dog life, it's a very difficult thing to contemplate and to deal with. And we have, you know, two young kids, and they have to deal with it as well.
I think that family unit, that structure, is very interesting, especially with children in the household, because there's a special bond there. But also for people that either do not have children or have had their children leave the home, that pet often becomes a replacement in a lot of ways, and that relationship is maintained. And it is a very interesting phenomenon. It's not just about the medicine aspects of it. It's about the human-animal bond and things that are not necessarily something you get out of a textbook.
Mm-hmm. There is a question that actually we're trying to grapple with, and that is the idea of maybe adding a new family member, a young dog, but we're not sure if that's the best idea for the health of our current animal companion. You know, it's hard to say how she'd react, so I guess it probably just depends on the animal.
It's a mixed bag.
Yeah.
It may be a blessing. I mean, we have documented cases where younger pets have come into the household, and that's rejuvenated the older pet. And we've also had cases where the older pet has not really accepted the younger pet. I think there's ways of doing it appropriately and introducing them gradually and giving it some time. But it does depend on the mentality and the personality of each of the pets involved.
One thing that we've observed is that as she gets older, her behavior and expectations and what she wants around our household has changed as well. And in particular, she can't stand it when any single member of the house is gone. Everybody has to be there, and then it's okay. You know, if anybody else is gone, then there's this sort of, you know, anxiety that she experiences.
I don't know that the aging process in animals is really any different than the aging process in people.
Yeah.
It may be over a different time course, but I think if you talk to people that do geriatric medicine with people and senior care, I think we would have a lot of similarities.
Very interesting. Well, we're almost at our midpoint here. We're talking with Stephen Marks and Julia Whittington, both of the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. This is a show we call Talk to the Veterinarian. If you have questions for us, you can call us either about household animal members of your family. We used to call them companion animals. I guess the term keeps – we can be flexible as far as how we describe it. Also, Julia Whittington directs the Wildlife Clinic, so questions on those kinds of issues are welcome as well. All you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Champaign, line number one. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a couple of questions, one about cats and one about chickens.
You have your bases covered, I think.
Don't put them in the same...
Exactly. Yeah. Not in the same sentence.
All right. I'll ask the one about chickens first. I grew up on a farm, and at one time we had chickens, and we did something I learned how to do something which was kind of interesting, and I've never been able to understand it. If you have a hard, light-colored surface with a line, straight line on it, that ends, and take a chicken and place its feet astraddle a line and put its beak to the tip of the line, the chicken will stand there a while as if it's frozen in place. We used to call this hypnotizing a chicken. Have you ever heard of this?
You know,
I have actually.
I've heard of it, but I don't know that I could tell you the physiology of that.
I don't know the physiology. I'll tell you, when I first went, before I went to veterinary school, I was an animal science major, and I worked in the poultry department at the University of Delaware, which is a big poultry area. And it wasn't always done the same way, but we would have these gentlemen that were old-time chicken farmers that would come in, and they would actually – they could place a hen on its sternum or on its keel bone and – lay it flat and point its eyes at an object like a pencil or a line, and they would call it hypnotizing the chicken. And I would have bet everything I know about veterinary medicine against that, but it seemed to work, and they would lay still for a couple of minutes.
Is that sort of like tipping cows?
I think that tipping cows is a little bit more urban legend. It's rural legend.
I went snipe hunting once, by
the
way.
There you go.
Anyway.
I mean, we actually have some people in ACES that specifically are animal scientists that work with poultry, and we can probably check that out for you a little bit more if you want to give us a call back sometime.
All right. And the other thing is about our cats, specifically one of them. They're litter mates, and they're just going on 4 years. And the one that's a little bit bigger and more muscular, they're both neutered males, it, like many cats, just loves to be scratched in certain areas. What amazes me is that they press against the scratching, and they press really, really hard, so hard that I'd think it would be painful to them. Is there any risk of harming them, particularly in places like right behind the ear or at the base of the tail?
No, you're probably fairly safe. It's actually interesting. If you want to do some interesting reading, you can either go on the internet or you can go to Barnes & Noble or Amazon.com, and there's some incredible feline behavioral books out there that just tell you about feline behavior. And you'll find a lot of what you and I would consider just loving behavior of cats is actually natural inherent behavior of cats. And when they push up like you're describing, they're usually marking you. They're marking you as their property. So it's not strictly that they really like being scratched. It's also a behavioral process that comes with being a cat. So that's actually fairly common, and I would not worry about hurting the pet.
Is it also rather pleasurable for them?
Oh, I think it is. I mean, my cat does the same thing. My cat will run up to me and just basically headbutt my leg. He will throw himself at my legs, my arms, and it is pleasurable for them. But it's also part of their inherent behavior.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, cats, as many people have commented, can be fairly strange. A friend of mine had a cat who would express its pleasure by hissing, you know, like the usual warning sound of cats, but it was rather unnerving.
They are a very interesting species, both in their behavior, their attitudes. They're very challenging, and with the diseases that they get as well, they're very, very challenging species.
We have another caller, Champagne, line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Is this me?
Yes.
Okay. Actually, my question is about cats. Could you explain the phenomena of feline leukemia in terms of what it is in terms of, like, virus, whatever, and why the vaccine may or may not be effective?
That's actually, I mean, that's a fairly complicated question, and a very good one, I might add, and it's several days worth of lecture for sure.
Oh, sorry.
No, but I think it's I think what you need to know and the pros and cons of it, we can run through. Basically, feline leukemia is a virus, and it's an infectious disease. We believe that it has some effects on the immune system of cats. And most of the time, these cats, when they become ill from the virus, when they actually have the virus and they become ill from the virus, it's usually associated disease, and the ones that we primarily see is we can actually see the true leukemia, which is a disease of the bone marrow associated with feline leukemia, but we can also see neoplasia, and neoplasia would be another word for cancer. The primary cancer we see associated with feline leukemia is actually lymphoma or lymphosarcoma. We often pair this disease, feline leukemia, with FIV, which is feline immunodeficiency virus, and most of the marketed tests test for both of those viruses together. The problem is the efficacy of the feline leukemia virus is fairly iffy, and meaning that it doesn't provide protection across the board. And right now, the recommendations across the board from the American Veterinary Medical Association and also other organizations that look at vaccines and Dawson cats are recommending only using that vaccine in high-risk cats. And by high-risk cats, we mean cats that spend a great deal of time outdoors and that are in contact with other cats. And that's probably the primary mode of transmission. Does that answer the majority of your questions?
Yes, but it's still not really a guarantee of protection?
No, it's not. In fact, I mean, and this gets somewhat controversial, and you should always sit down and talk with the veterinarian that you're working with your pet. But realistically, if you look at the rate of feline leukemia in, say, a cat that spends the majority of its days indoors, the incidence of that disease is very low. Okay, and then the lapse in protection of the vaccine is very similar, which means there's probably no benefit if you have a cat that's low risk in vaccinating. The other side of that story is that there's pretty good research now supporting that we potentially do over-vaccinate pets and that vaccines are not without complication. So if you're potentially putting a pet at risk via the vaccination, mind you, it's very minimal. But the protection is also minimal because it's unlikely that your cat's going to actually have feline leukemia. Then you're putting your cat at risk for no reason.
Yeah, well, I asked because we recently had a cat die from feline leukemia, and we're trying to decide whether to get another one, knowing that it's next to impossible for us to keep our cat inside all the time.
Right.
And so that's why it's like...
I mean, if your cat's an indoor-outdoor cat, it's probably recommended to have that cat vaccinated for feline leukemia.
Okay.
But it does not guarantee you 100% protection.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
My pleasure.
Okay, thanks for the call. Other calls are welcome. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. It's interesting to hear you say that we're perhaps over-vaccinating in some cases. Are there, you know, for cats in this case, what about dogs?
It basically is the same. In fact, of the species, we probably over-vaccinate dogs because most city ordinances require vaccination of dogs. And cats, as you know, in this area, it's been somewhat controversial. They're trying to introduce that rabies vaccination as a requirement of licensing in cats. It is very controversial. There are still veterinarians, and there may be veterinarians right now that are saying, oh my God, why is he saying that? But the reality is right now there is information that shows these vaccines provide protection longer than the annual period that we're routinely recommending. Now, veterinarians have no choice in rabies vaccine. That's dictated by local jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. But as far as the other infectious disease we vaccinate for, that is between the pet owner and the veterinarian.
Mm-hmm. Are there health implications of the vaccination then? I mean, what's the downside?
The downside is that we probably are seeing more immune-mediated diseases potentially induced by vaccination. And the biggest issue is the induction of what's referred to as vaccine-associated sarcoma, primarily in the cat. And that's a tumor that we believe has been induced by vaccinating.
Yeah. I imagine there's a lot of research going on this.
There is. It's huge, and it's something that's quite controversial right now. And I don't mean to say that's the way it will be, but that's the way it's looking right now.
Okay. Well, our line's filled up. Let's talk with some more callers. Next up, someone in Urbana, line number one. Good morning.
Hi. I had a wildlife question. We have a couple of man-made ponds behind our house that they just came in a couple years ago. And we have... a mother duck with about 6 ducklings, and we've enjoyed watching them grow up. It's been fun. But then about a month ago, there was another mother duck with about 12 smaller ducklings. They looked like they were a little bit younger, and we were really excited about it. But they were only there that one day that we saw them, and we've never seen them again. So I didn't know if that's pretty common to, like, you know, they would just, you know, move on somewhere else.
Certainly the ducks, especially if you have a limited space and more than one clutch or one family group in an area, they will try to space themselves out appropriately. And it's not uncommon, especially depending on the species of the duck, for them to actually migrate short distances because they have ducklings usually on foot between different ponds. Especially since the ones that you were describing that had the 12 were a little bit younger, it's possible that she took them to a different, more secluded area in order to keep them free of danger. But it's also possible that they fell victim to some sort of predation.
Well, that's what I was afraid of, and I was hoping that, well, maybe she just took them somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. And unfortunately, I hate to use the term, they are sitting ducks.
Yeah.
Sorry. But you know, they have very little defenses at that age. And you know, we were talking about indoor-outdoor cats. I'm afraid to say that our domestic cats are one of the biggest predators of our wild birds.
Sure.
And, you know, it's sad to see sometimes, but hopefully it all sort of evens out in the end. But it's possible that she went to another place.
Sure. Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks for the call. Another Urbana caller next on line number 3. Good morning.
I'm here. Hello.
Mm-hmm. Hello. Yes.
Turning this down, okay? Hello?
Yes.
My question is also wildlife. I was out at the State Peoria Wild Park recently,
mm-hmm.
and it was high noon. It was a beautiful Saturday, and in two different enclosures, two large black bears were snoozing in the sun, okay? And they're lying on their side, and they've got a log against their stomach. You know, they're lying sort of around a log, and they've got their front and back right hand, arms, legs, hanging over the log, okay? And they're snoozing away. And out behind them, all around them, the ground is dry. Out behind each of those two bears, there's this long rivulet of wet. My question is, do bears urinate when they go to sleep, when they relax? Do they just poof?
It's a good question, and I don't know that I could tell you specifically the answer, but my guess would be that they're similar to other mammals, which is that they would only urinate and defecate upon an active process. So unless they had some medical process that allowed them to be incontinent, I would guess that they had control over their excrement. I wonder if what you were seeing, perhaps they had been in some water source, because they will do
There's
that
no
to
water
cool
source.
Off.
The bears don't have a pond.
No, they don't.
Mm-mm.
I'm not sure what you were seeing then, but I don't think that they would have been passing urine in their sleep.
Okay, so they probably just decided to go.
It's quite possible.
But it was really kind of remarkable. One bear, well, yes, but two bears, you know, far different enclosures, both sound asleep. Well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks
Bye.
For the call. We were just down in the Smoky Mountains and saw some black bears down there. Just amazing.
Oh, they're beautiful.
They are.
They're more beautiful from up close, mm-hmm. but they're a little bit safer from a distance.
Yeah, we didn't want to get too close.
Right.
Yeah, they were in the distance, but we saw a mother and two cubs.
I think all the bears are amazing. I mean, I was at Washington State when I did my early training, and they had a rehab unit for grizzly bears. And if you know Washington State's in Pullman, Washington, it's one huge wheat field. And to see this double enclosure with grizzly bears running across through a pasture is just – it's an amazing sight, because if there wasn't the fence there, you'd be running the other direction fairly
right.
rapidly.
And they'd be running faster probably.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're amazing creatures, certainly. Now, there used to be bears in this area, weren't there? Or do you know offhand? Or,
I don't know.
Okay, the range. But there are none in the state, isn't that right? None in Illinois?
No.
But if you go down south and to the east, you know, you get into the mountainous regions, and that's more there.
The black bear.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. What about, I'm just curious now, because I've heard that there are an increasing number of wild cats in the
there
Midwest.
There are. We actually do have bobcats in Illinois, and there have been reported a gray wolf now in Illinois and in the Midwest. And, you know, so I think that certainly as we urbanize, as our suburbs get more of a sprawl and we go into what's left of any wild area, we're going to see more of these predators, these top predators, come in and be where we are. And, of course, then you're going to have increased interaction, and this is nothing new, you know, where you hear all the time about cougars coming into, you know, downtown Denver and picking off people's poodles. And that's going to happen the more interaction you have and the more we impinge upon wild areas.
Now, with that interaction comes a certain amount of, I gather every once in a while, panic about, you know, what's the danger of
you
these
bet.
Animals. Yeah.
You bet. And, you know, then you've got, you can get into all kinds of controversies with wildlife. You know, for instance, let's talk about a prairie dog. You know, these are animals that are kept as pets, and in appropriate situations, they can be very good pets. It does take a specific sort of situation for them to remain healthy. But if these animals are caught in the wild, as they sometimes are, then it really puts a lot of pressure on the natural population. And then you deal with ranchers who are working their herds in prairie dog fields, and they're upset that the prairie dogs are eating the grass. But if you actually look at the ecology, the prairie dogs are maintaining that grass population. So all of these animals are interconnected, and we all sort of depend on each other to maintain the health of all of the populations.
Well, very good. We have several callers. Let's go on and talk with our next listener in Mattoon, line number 4. Good morning.
Good morning. I have another cat question for you. I've got 3 cats. 2 of them are long hair. 1 is a short hair. And it's a hairball question.
Okay.
And what I've got, I brush them virtually every day. I use like a slicker type brush, and my wife also just got me a glove thing that has rubber knobs on it that's
right.
Pretty good at doing
it. Yeah, that works well.
And I'm still getting cats with hairballs. And, of course, the prolific shedding at this time of the year. And interestingly enough, the short hair is the biggest shedder.
Right.
But I feed them. They're basically indoor cats. Once in a while, they will get outside. I feed them a combination of what dry food. All they eat is dry food. And one is a straight hairball formula, and the other is an indoor cat formula that's supposed to work for weight management and also for hairballs. I'm wondering if you've got any other suggestions, because I don't like cleaning up the little presents they leave all over, and 2, I'm concerned about the cat's overall health and well-being.
Yeah, you face a fairly difficult dilemma. I mean, the reality is, these cats will continue to get hairballs for the most part, because there's usually group grooming. It's part of the cat's social habit,
mm-hmm.
And so I think even keeping up as much as you can, you're probably going to still see problems. The only thing you can do, it's great that you've tried to use some of the marketed hairball diets. The other thing you can try is some of the hairball products, and any veterinarian will carry it. There's products like Laxatone. They're basically laxatives,
right.
And all they do is allow – because what I'm saying is you're never going to get rid of the hairballs, not
right.
Completely. So what you really have to do is you have to jump ahead and say, how do we treat this so the cat doesn't vomit or regurgitate these hairballs?
Mm-hmm.
And so Laxatone and there's many other products out there. You can get some of them over the counter. I usually recommend just going straight to your veterinarian asking. They're flavored products. They usually come in a tube, and it's dispensed like toothpaste.
Yeah, I've used those before, but not for a couple of years.
Well, what you may try, and you may just try this. And again, I would always talk to your veterinarian that knows these pets and has seen these pets.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be try once or twice a week, adding this into their routine and turning it into a treat, in addition to what you're doing right now. So maintaining the brushing and the hairball diet, and see if we can reduce the phenomena.
Okay, and then I had another question, too. Mm-hmm. As I said, they're basically indoor cats, although occasionally they do get outside. I'm debating whether to have them declawed, at least on the front feet. 2 of the cats are about 5 years old. The other is about 4 years old. And I've heard that with older cats, it can sometimes be a touchy thing to have them declawed. However, we're trying to protect the furniture, basically.
Right. There are now, amongst different people, veterinarians and pet owners, ethical questions concerned with declawing, but technically it's a surgical procedure,
mm-hmm.
And in older pets, it's it's certainly a little bit more difficult procedure than it is in younger pets. But if those pets are healthy and they are good anesthetic candidates, and they're provided pain management after and during the procedure, which most veterinarians will do, they usually do fairly well.
Okay.
There are some more novel surgeries that can be done where they're not actually removing the nails, but they're actually doing surgery on the tendons that allow the cat to extend the claws,
mm-hmm.
And that surgery is also available at several practices.
Well, my dilemma is if they did get out and they were declawed, that they wouldn't be able to climb, to flee, or to fight to protect themselves should the need arise. And so I've kind of hesitated on that, on those grounds, and then the basic health thing.
Right. It's hard to be a strict proponent of declaw, but if you are going to do that, then most folks will recommend just doing a front claw declaw.
Right. That's what
and most cats can get around pretty well and climb a tree and your leg, I assure you, with just the hind limb claws intact.
All righty. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks for the call. Next up, a Champagne listener on line number 2. Good morning. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I have a concern for wildlife also. Having seen a not seen very many blue jays or other birds here lately. I'm wondering if the flyways have been compromised by the all the new frequencies, the computers, the cell phones, the wireless outfits, AM, FMs are giving a lot more frequency. Does that have any effect on the wildlife and their flyways?
The frequencies, the radio wave frequencies themselves, don't really affect the birds' migratory paths or their ability. However, certainly we get a lot of mortality from birds who have collisions with these cell towers.
Oh, yeah.
And power lines. And then as we do develop areas that provide them with stopovers along their flyway, they have fewer and fewer sites in which to lay over during their migratory paths and subsequently to nest once they do come to their breeding ground. So there are a lot of things that are happening with development and, you know, communication development that will affect the bird populations, and that's something that people look at quite extensively to see, you know, we're not going to stop development, but is there a way that we can do it so that it will have the least impact on these species and protect the populations?
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for the call. Our house, there are more birds this year than I've ever seen, actually. It's kind of amazing, including a couple of different families of cardinals who I thought, you know, were very territorial and wouldn't share the same space.
This morning we drove out of our driveway and we saw a black vulture munching on something that had met with a car, and the kids were wondering if that happened to be Simba getting eaten by the buzzards. And, you know, I had to explain that, no, we don't have African lions in Illinois, but we do have buzzards.
And bobcats.
And bobcats.
Occasionally. Yeah, I've never seen, would a bobcat be, what kind of terrain would they be attracted to?
They're generally in this, in Illinois, they're generally down south near the forested areas. But they survive fairly well on small mammal prey. So they'll eat rabbits and they'll eat fox and raccoon. And so that they will be somewhat generalists, but they'll like to have their cover as well.
Another caller on line number one in Belgium next. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to bring up a couple topics. The first one is that you mentioned, are there bears in Illinois? There are not any today, but one of the most horrid things that the early settlers came across was the prairie grizzly, which is an extremely vicious animal. And Indians had lots of problems with them, too. They have long since been eradicated from our area, obviously. The other thing I wanted to bring up to you was that you were talking about poles. Here in the news just very recently, there was a wildfire started in California by what they said was a red-tailed hawk crossing a power line. I see those very, very regularly here in our area. A lot of power lines have a way of, in the country, they have a way of running the hot line on the top, and the hawks will naturally roost on the poles. And you'll go down the countryside, and you'll see them not every day, but you'll see them regularly dead at the base of a pole or dangling from the pole, electrocuted, which is a horrid thing. I wish we could find the power company some way to stop that from being able to happen.
And unfortunately, a lot of that occurs when they will take their prey that they've hunted and bring it up to the pole to eat it, and that prey will actually cross the lines.
Yes, ma'am.
It's a real problem for our wild raptors.
Yep. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. Certainly, the population of red-tailed hawks has been remarked upon as expanding in the last few years.
And definitely.
It's really kind of amazing how many animals that, and I don't want to say that we're doing all right in every category of taking care of the environment, but certainly animals that seem to be in grave decline, in tough shape, are a lot of them coming back.
Some of them, yes. Certainly. And a lot of it depends on their habitat and when they reach breeding maturity and all different factors. I would say red-tailed hawks and great horned owls were two species that were hit incredibly hard that first year we had West Nile virus. And a lot of people were concerned that perhaps it would be a very hard impact on their populations. But these are birds that are also very much generalists, and they don't seem to mind people and living around habitat that is occupied by people. So they have been able to bounce back, but then certainly there are populations that are just horribly affected by us and are reaching some critical status.
We have one more caller on line number 4 in near Brazil, Indiana, if I got that right. Good morning.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I just tuned in, and I'm sorry, I'll keep this brief because I know you're just about out of time. For several years now, several of our neighbors in southern Illinois have, over time, reported sighting a black panther. Have you heard anything about that?
Black panther.
They've seen it next to the railroad track. One of them saw it near their pasture. My mother saw it out in our CPR ground.
A black panther?
Yes.
Hmm. No, I don't have any knowledge of those sightings. So I really can't comment on that. Have the wildlife officials in that area come out with anything?
I have no idea. Mm-hmm. I really don't know. It's been some time since I've lived there myself. Mm-hmm. But I was just curious if anybody had said anything. Because many years ago, when I was living near Peoria, I lived out in the boondocks in a cabin. And I would hear a cat at night sometimes. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while, somebody would say that they had seen the black cat, not a tawny one, but mm-hmm. a black one.
Interesting. No, I don't have any knowledge of those reports.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Bye.
Well, that would certainly be interesting.
That would be something to hear.
Well, we're at the end of our time, so we're going to have to stop. There are a number of issues that we could talk about, so we'll just have to have you back again if you'd be willing to.
That'd be great. Thank you for having us.
That would be wonderful. Our guests during this hour, Focus 580, Stephen Marks, Chief of Small Animal Medicine, and Julia Whittington, Assistant Professor of Veterinary Medicine and Head of the Wildlife Clinic at the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. And thanks once again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
That's it for this hour, Focus 580. When we return in a few minutes, we'll have an archived interview with Simon Head, director of the Project on Technology in the Workplace at the Century Foundation, and author of the book, The Ruthless Economy, Work and Power in the Digital Age. Again, that's an archive interview during the 11 o'clock hour, so we can't take calls during that hour. First, though, we'll take a break for some news and a market update.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Prices on the Chicago Board of Trade are holding their own today, mostly on short profit-taking on a Friday. We'll look at the specifics. September wheat holding at 329, up 6 1/4. December, 342 1/4, up 6. September corn, 223 3/4, up 4 1/2. December, 232, up 4 1/4. March, 240 1/4, up 4 1/4. May, 246 1/4, up 4 1/4. August soybeans, 676, up 18 1/2 after being limit down yesterday. September, 620, up 19 1/2. November, 612, up 18 1/4. August soybean meal, 221.20.